welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM. My name is Eddie Lesher, and I'll be joined very soon by my co-host, Margaret Kirshner, and our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at WPVMFM.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And thank you very much to our listeners for joining us for another edition of Mindful Emergence. This program is being broadcast live Monday, October 23rd, 2017. And Margaret, it is program number 94.
Wow.
Yeah. All right, we're coming up pretty soon. We're going to hit our two-year anniversary in about a month. Our first program was November 23rd of 2015.
We've learned a lot.
We have, and we've had so many wonderful guests, and this week is no exception. So I want to welcome into the studio Dr. Daniel Foer, who is a psychotherapist and doctor of psychology. And the theme this week is transforming the ancestral roots of addiction. So welcome to our studio, Daniel. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
And so give us an idea, this topic, transforming the ancestral roots of addiction. Now, your background is you're a licensed psychotherapist and doctor of psychology, as I mentioned, and you've led ancestral and family healing intensives throughout the U.S. since 2005. And we'll talk more a little bit about some of the traditions you've been initiated in and teachers you've trained with and the work that you do. But what are we going to be talking about over the next almost an hour?
Well, I hope to introduce a framework for ancestor reverence and ritual that allows for a conversation to then happen about addiction through that animist or more relational framework.
Okay. So let's start right off by defining animist.
Yeah, animism is a clunky intellectual word that has some baggage from white European colonialist anthropologists, but has been reclaimed as a useful way to describe a way of seeing the world that goes basically like this. Living human beings are just one kind of person. There are many other kinds of people. The ancestors, the not incarnate right now, humans, are another kind of person. The animals, the plants, the mountains, the rivers, deities, spirits of nature, many other kinds of beings we don't have good English words for, are also kinds of people that warrant our consideration, that we have an ethical or moral imperative to try to relate respectfully with. And it's a way of describing a worldview without infringing upon indigenous cultures when someone like myself of German, English, Irish ancestry is not, I'm not an indigenous person, and yet I assert that the world is relational as I see it, and humans are not necessarily at the center of that world. So animism is a way of getting at that without using the word shamanism, without claiming to be indigenous.
Mm-hmm. And certainly when I think of animism, I do tend to think of the indigenous cultures, for example, the Native American traditions.
For sure.
I've done a lot of sweat lodge ceremonies, and it was very clear that there was a very strong connection with all these other forms of life.
For sure.
Outside of me.
For sure. That's right. Yeah. And if in order for us to know ourselves well, it requires us to attempt to relate respectfully with that bigger field of relationships. Mm-hmm. And it frames illness, health, community, all other aspects of life to bring that relational frame to everyday life.
And this informs the work that you do as a psychotherapist.
It does. I don't technically work under my license these days, although I am still licensed as a therapist. I tend to do more explicitly ritual or ceremonial type work. Mm-hmm. Training as a therapist was one of the best things I could have done as a ritualist, because there's a lot of spiritual teachers who could benefit from greater psychological training.
For sure. And we're certainly going to dig in deep and explore these different approaches that you take in your work. But I'm curious how you got into this. Not something that's, I would say, typical.
Oh, for sure.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in northeastern Ohio, and mm-hmm. I wasn't raised with any framework for this, but I had some early experiences as a teenager of using psychoactive substances and mm-hmm. being cracked open to the reality of spirits or things that were not physically incarnate in any obvious way, but had a certain responsiveness and reality to them. And so I sought a framework for that. It led me to get a minor in religious studies, and I had the good fortune at age 17 even to connect with my first teachers in shamanic practice, paganism. And so I got a framework early on for relating with other than humans.
And where did that happen?
That was in southeastern Ohio at Ohio University with Becky and Crow of the Church of Earth Healing.
So that's where you did your undergrad work.
It is, yeah. And then I've had the good fortune to live in some other countries and to travel a bit, and have worked with both indigenous teachers and other than indigenous traditions like Islam and Mahayana Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And I'm also an initiate in Ifa Arisha tradition in Yoruba-speaking West Africa, in the lineage of Oluwafalolu Adesanya Woyade, who was just here in Asheville. And it was great to have him and the family here. I've been there four times mm-hmm. myself, and yeah.
Well, that's quite a leap. I mean, from going to doing undergraduate work in Ohio to spending this time in Nigeria, other places?
There's a few things in between, but the years of... I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area for 11 years, and mm-hmm. I did a lot of land-focused ritual there, and I sat in a lot of Native North American ceremonies, sweat lodges, Native American church, questing ceremonies, and did some Zen training, and immersed myself in a lot of different traditions, trying to find myself and my own personal medicine and where I needed to focus. And through the psychological training and through the application of ancestor-focused ritual in my own life, and just being tenacious about it, it became clear that I'm more at home in indigenous or earth-honoring systems. And finally, over time, with Yoruba tradition, I found a warm welcome there and stepped in through initiations in the last... Oh, really 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, the theme is transforming the ancestral roots of addiction. And it's obviously not a big news flash that we have this massive epidemic of addiction, not just in this country, but certainly it is so pervasive in so many parts of this country. And, of course, it crosses age groups, ethnic groups, everything. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing out in the world as you navigate it in terms of the addiction and how it's impacting the community that you're part of, Daniel?
Sure. Addiction can look so many ways, and we tend to frame psychological troubles as personal troubles, and I tend to frame them a bit more heavily as family, systemic troubles, and even cultural troubles. And so when I think of addiction and how we frame it, because that informs everything about treatment and how we hold such a thing culturally, I think of intimacy, relational intimacy, and that many people who suffer with addiction of whatever sort are acting out in a way that may not be very successful or adaptive, a longing for greater intimacy and connection. And so what prevents that? A number of things prevent it. One is our framework that says only living humans are real. And so relating with the ancestors, relating with the land, relating with the sacred powers, none of that is on the table. And so there's a whole like 80-90% of the potential relational intimacy a person might enjoy is truncated by a colonialist, reductionist, Western materialist worldview. And on top of that, we're sitting in the United States with a history of genocide toward Native peoples and African peoples, and a lot of unhealed trauma around sexism, racism, colonialism, etc. And that, of course, in more obvious ways, burdens people of color, women, queer, LGBTQ mm-hmm. people, and also differently, ancestrally burdens the European ancestored people whose ancestors have enacted these harms. And so there's an undigested debt or burden that even white people carry that can be a component in addiction as well. There's a kind of hungry ghost problem.
Yeah, say more about that hungry ghost. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, for sure. So to back up to the topic of the ancestors, specifically the blood ancestors, what's important to know is that not all of the dead are equally well. Just like the living, those who are in spirit, those who are previously incarnate in human form, run the full spectrum from deeply beneficial and helpful and loving to quite troubled and tormented or even hateful and aggressive. And, you know, we know this about living people, that not everyone is leading with love and light. And it's the same among the dead. And because we don't tend to care for our dead in this culture, we tend to have the view that our moral and ethical accountability to family ends with their death. We're not doing rituals typically to make sure they're ancestrally seated. We have an intergenerational backlog that comes from not staying in relationship with the dead. So there's a lot of those among the dead who are not yet at peace. And often it is the case that they haven't left. And so they can be a source of interference and trouble and disruption for the living.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on your dial, and streaming globally at WPVMFM.org. Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by Dr. Daniel Foer, talking about the transforming the ancestral roots of addiction. So you've had the opportunity to spend time in a number of different cultures and in spiritual traditions. Mm-hmm. What kind of continuity do you see across traditions? And I'll just make a little comment. When you were talking about, the relationship between us and those who have, I would say, gone to the other side or mm-hmm. or transitioned, I think about some of the traditions, some of the practices in Mahayana. For example, you're probably familiar with the Poa. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you notice in terms of the various cultures?
What I hold to be cross-cultural assumptions about ancestor reverence or the relationship between the living and the dead would be that there's some continuity of consciousness after death. That can be multiple things because the soul is multiple, as I see it. Many cultures see it that way. So what happens to us when we die? Well, different things can happen to the collective of things that responds to Daniel. And another assumption is that not all the dead are equally well, which I spoke to, and that they can change. They can become well if they're not yet well. Another is that we can communicate with them. It's actually a very normal thing. It doesn't make a person spiritual or special to communicate with the dead. It's as normal as communicating with the living. And finally, the level of impact between the living and the dead is substantial. It's not optional. We can't opt out of a relationship with their ancestors. We can have that be unconscious, which doesn't mean it's going to be bad. It just means we won't have leverage over it because it's not conscious. And so we're inseparable from them structurally. And they may not be at peace, but they might be. And ideally, we draw on them as a source of support. Traditional people take care of the dead partly to protect themselves from the dead. Even if you traditionally execute a person, you make sure they become an ancestor so they don't haunt the community. And so even the most troubled and rejected and shamed community members are still, upon death, typically addressed ritually to make sure that they transform and become more healed.
So in our culture, we haven't been conditioned to think of honoring our ancestors as some other cultures have. So if we want to begin a relationship with our ancestors who have passed before us, you know, whether they are, you know, grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, you know, extended relatives, how do we create reverence and connection?
Sure. It's a big question, but three things that come to mind. One is make the distinction between the dead who are deeply at peace and those who are not yet well. And seek only at the start to relate with those who are deeply at peace. So you can say, I open to the support of my wise and loving and kind grandmothers and grandfathers. Two, recognize that the ancestors are not just individuals and they're not just recent people. Along each of the lineages of those listening, there are deeply awake, well, loving, kind ancestors, even if those ones lived before the last, say, 500 years of colonialism. And so the dead include the much older ancestors, and they may function more as a group or a lineage, a collective kind of hive intelligence, rather than individuals only. And finally, as a basic practice, just speak out loud to them. Like grandmothers.
Speak out loud.
Yeah, grandmothers, grandfathers. I have no idea if this is getting through. I know you technically exist. I'm open to your support and love and backing. I'm not sure how to do this. Show me a sign. Help me out. Love you.
Have you had experience, direct experience yourself?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I'm a distributor of this stuff. So I have. It's been a very potent and transformative for me to come to value my own blood ancestors. I used to see my family as the least spiritual thing I could think of.
So I have to say, I don't really think about my ancestors much.
Sure. Yeah.
My parents have both passed on and have for some time. Mm-hmm. It never occurs to me to communicate with them.
Sure.
What is that costing me?
Well, you seem like a well human being to me.
You're catching me on a good day, Dan.
Right? chances are you already enjoy a lot of unconscious backing from them because you've done a lot of inner work and you're being of service to people. So when you're being an ethical and helpful human being, you bring honor to your people and a sense of satisfaction to them. And we'll know them eventually when we die, because to get oriented, at least some aspect of our soul is connected through blood to our people. And so chances are you'll be received just fine when that comes. And in the meantime, there is an invitation to direct intimate connection with them. And probably if you were to do that, you might realize that some of what you've been guided to in your life is actually a continuation of their gifts and their legacy.
I would agree with that. And so let me just throw this in the mix. I'm involved in 12-step recovery as a person in long-term recovery. And we have a process that we go through in our steps called making amends. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, there are situations where someone says, I'd really like to make an amends to so-and-so, but they've passed on. So we have an expression called living amends. Mm-hmm. So I think you alluded to this. You know, if somebody goes on and really lives a life of integrity, you know, this is a form of living amends. But I will say that I did things and I made decisions that were really hurtful to my parents, and I have never told them, you know, I didn't have an opportunity to tell them that. Uh-huh. I like to think that I've made living amends in terms of how I go about my life. But what might be something that I could do?
In a situation like that, you could call around you the really wise and helpful, benevolent elder grandmothers and grandfathers before you and any other helpful deities or spirits you work with and ask them to hold a mediated space for you to speak directly to your parents. Probably one at a time, or maybe both, and speak from the heart to them and make a space also to just be in a listening awareness and let the energy move, because they are very available ultimately. Mm-hmm. And we can address them directly, and that may be important for them, it may be important for you, it may be important for both. But again, the communication between the living and the dead is very normal. It's culturally like an everyday kind of thing. Yeah, so that's just speak to them directly, but have a bigger force than you or them hold a safe container ritually for the interaction. That's all. Do it in an intentional space, because you're calling the dead to be near, and so it's good to be intentional about it. Mm. Yeah.
It seems as though what you're saying is that when we heal backward in time, forward in time, all around us.
It's
Could
true.
That be a way of
Yeah, it's true. Time
it?
Is not so linear in a spirit way. My one story that captures something of this is my grandpa, my dad's dad's suicide. He shot himself in the abdomen, and he, obviously it was very traumatic for the family. And, but the first, my entry into this work in the late 90s was a ritual of intervention of healing for him. And what I was shown is ancestors from, 1800 years ago in northern Germany being run through with swords from Roman conqueror type people, and then realized in the abdomen though. And I didn't realize where the work was headed for the day. And then I, through ancestor research, realized my great-great-great-grandpa Ford died of dysentery in a rebel prison camp. And he died in a rebel prison camp, probably of dysentery. His son, my great-great-grandpa, died of some digestive thing 70 years earlier to the day that his grandson shot himself. Mm-hmm. And so what came clear to me is that the moment that Roman occupiers are humiliating and conquering tribal Germany is the same moment in time that my great-great-great-grandpa Martin Four is dying of dysentery because of the Confederacy is the same moment in time that my grandfather's shooting himself in the abdomen. And it's the same moment in time that I either choose to be connected to my belly, my authentic needs, a healthy, comfortable sense of power and communication, or not. And so the patterns will either recreate really generously and destructively or not. So if we can get to the underlying narrative or story about what's the original wound, what's this pattern that keeps recreating itself, we can, in a sense, heal that in all other places in time as well.
It's a courageous step to wake up and to honor our ancestors.
It's good to know that we're not separable from the larger web. Addiction grows strong in a condition of isolation or shame or separateness, because addiction is a regulation of the nervous system. It can become a dysregulation, of course, but it's a kind of mothering. And so alcohol, tobacco, gambling, sex, sugar, whatever, those are big spirits that step in to mother people.
As a form of comfort seeking.
For sure. Yeah. And self-soothing. Yeah.
Sure.
Understandable.
Sure. Unfortunately, they become compulsive.
Oh, no doubt.
And destructive in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk about dreams? How sometimes our loved ones who've passed on come to us through dreams?
For sure. Dreams, like waking thoughts, may be more about the dreamer and more about the thinker, or they may have an element of contact with them. And so often we instinctually know the difference when we've been contacted by someone who's passed or by some other type of spirit. There's a sense of, wow, so-and-so really was there. That was an encounter. And those encounters, like an encounter with the living, can run the full spectrum from so-and-so seemed quite troubled to so-and-so was extending a blessing and kindness. When the dead are troubled and their family members or those we are close to, consider that it may be real. They may actually be troubled. And there are ways for the living to effectively intervene to assist the dead. If someone called us who's a friend and they're like, hey, I'm stranded out on the street in the middle of the night, we wouldn't be like, I wonder if that's real. Click. But so we do that with a dream. And so sometimes the dead actually contact us and they're like, hey, help out. I'm stuck here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. It would seem that someone who has grandchildren, great-grandchildren, could do a great service to them by sharing their own personal history.
For sure. And cleaning up the ancestral legacy. the few thousand folks in the last decade plus that I've stepped through ancestral repair work. And that's the work that's at the heart of the book, the heart of the online course I'm guiding, the heart of the practitioner training that I guide others in, is a safe, systematic way to repair damage along our ancestral bloodlines. And so for someone who's a parent or a grandparent, etc., to clean up that legacy and ensure that only the blessings reach their living or yet to be born descendants is a gift. It's a restoration of damage, cultural damage from mm-hmm. colonialism and from all the different systems that have caused our diverse frameworks for ancestor reverence to be fractured or diminished in some way.
This work seems particularly important today, these days. This past weekend, I went to a conference called ACE, Adverse Childhood Experiences mm-hmm. Summit, all about how what happens to us early in our lives, but also as we grow, has influence on our health and our well-being, mental, physical health and well-being. And it seems as though not only are we individually suffering, collectively as a system and society, we suffer.
Yeah, absolutely. If you set up a system that's financially exploitative and tends to deny a history of colonialist occupation and slavery and racism and sexism, and on top of that, you isolate people communally and don't give a framework for digesting family trauma, and you assume people have a lot of heavy, undigested abuse and trauma in their family system, how could childhood possibly go well? There's like parents are going to recreate unconsciously, despite their best intentions, the troubles that have preceded them, because we're beings that are embedded in multi-generational systems. And so I tend to see most psychological trouble that people would bring, say, to a therapy session as ancestral, as intergenerational. And people ask, how do you make a distinction between what's personal and what's systemic? It's all systemic. Like, sure, we might personally exist. I'm not sure one way or another about that. But it is a dependent origination here, to use some Buddhist jargon, on the nature of our suffering. It's cultural.
You mentioned you were at the, we both spent time at the San Francisco Zen Center.
That's
and
true.
You probably encountered Reb Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And Reb once made a comment. He said this, one of the greatest delusions, if not the greatest delusions human beings have, is that there's an I, a me,
right,
and the world out there.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that? And how do you relate to that in this context?
I would agree with it. I see, to bring it back to addiction, I see addiction as a kind of opportunistic condition, like a collection of forces and spirits and tendencies even that come in when a psyche is vulnerable. And an individual psyche may be vulnerable for all kinds of different reasons, but often because they're isolated, mm-hmm. they're not relationally woven in.
Yes.
They're not part of a bigger system and community. And so when we have that communal, interdependent rootedness, and we are aware that we matter to others and others matter to us, and there's a real sense of spiritual family that extends beyond just the human, we don't tend to be as vulnerable to addiction.
Yeah. Well, we see that a lot, and it's very unusual. Well, let me rephrase that. It's very common for people when they were in active addiction to isolate.
Sure.
And most, shame. Virtually all the recovery that I see happens in community.
Yeah,
happens
absolutely.
In community.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break here. You're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM FM in Asheville, North Carolina, with Margaret and Eddie. And I asked a question earlier about passing along wisdom to the children. And I picked out a song that I think sort of fits that theme.
On the road must have a code that you can live by, and so be become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
And you, of tender years, can't know the fears that your elders grew by. And so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well. Their children's hell will slowly go by. On your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they
obviously, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. This is Eddie LeSurin. From 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM, Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPVMFM.org, Mondays from 7 to 8 p.m. when we broadcast live, or Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 for the rebroadcast, past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. So here's how you find them. You go to WPVMFM.org, and then you click on the schedule and find our program, which is listed Mondays at 7, and you'll see a list of past programs. And as I mentioned earlier, this is program number 94. All our shows are made possible by A Mindful Emergence, LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. We also offer trainings for CEU credits to healthcare professionals. You can get more information by going online at amindfulemergence.com. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. And returning now to our guest, Dr. Daniel Foer, talking about transforming the ancestral roots of addiction. And this would be a good time for you to share your website, if you would, Daniel.
For sure. If folks would like more information on what I'm offering, please check out ancestralmedicine.org. And I do have an online course beginning this Sunday. And I train people in ancestral healing work, and there's hours of free talks and information there on the site.
They just go to the site and they can figure out how to get into that.
Same with information about the new book. It's called Ancestral Medicine.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, it's Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing, and I wrote it as an attempt to have a very thorough, pragmatic, culturally inclusive, but still ritually oriented guidebook on how to relate safely with the dead and how to transform lineage troubles.
Now, how unique is what you do in our culture? Are there many people doing this kind of work?
I think there's a fair number of people engaging the ancestors a little bit. And there are a handful of people who specialize in that. My approach has the qualities of being safety-oriented, psychologically-oriented, and systematic, learnable, replicable. And so I've intentionally kept it quite pared down to try to keep it culturally inclusive.
Yeah, your background as a psychotherapist obviously is important in understanding how to keep people safe.
It is. And as a ritualist, I'm not a big fan of belief or dogma. And so my approach to ritual is very pragmatic and results-oriented. Okay. So I'm not interested in people believing in the work. I'm interested in a methodology that gets results.
Well, that's very refreshing.
Cheers.
Yeah. So when I think about some of this work, a couple things come to mind, and I was wondering if there's a relevance. I remember back in the 80s, I believe it is, reading a book by Robert Bly called Iron John. Mm-hmm. And he talked a lot about, as well as Joseph Campbell. I encountered Joseph Campbell's work in the 90s. Of course, he did The Power of Myth and wrote all these wonderful books. And I think he just, I've learned so much from mm-hmm. what he has done. He talked about rites of passage. Mm-hmm. And of course, rites of passage are so much a part of these cultures that you speak about. I don't know if I should refer to them as indigenous or not. Is that an appropriate term?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, ritual is not unique to indigenous peoples,
well,
but for sure.
And what I think of in our culture is we do have rites of passage, but what it's called is joining a gang and shooting somebody as a proof of emergence into manhood. You know, this very distorted...
For sure. Generally speaking, rites of passage that function well, and of course they're very diverse from culture to culture, but they tend around the time someone has the responsibility of being able to conceive to the intent to put them in direct contact with the elder forces that hold up the universe, the gods, the holies, the archetypes, the deities, by whatever name. And not always, but for men, that may include coming into contact with the divine mothers and the grandmothers. And in being in communion with them, there's a bit of a tendency for projecting the goddess onto partners, assuming someone's heterosexual here, for the sake of making a point, or for women to come into direct communion with the divine masculine in the many diverse forms that appears, so that they do not expect their partner, assuming the person's male here, to embody that. And so when we have a direct relationship with the sacred, with the divine, not filtered through a lot of religious dogma, we enjoy greater intimacy from that, and also appropriate fear and accountability. And because fear, like awe and fear, has a place in spiritual life. And it's the fear that comes from not wishing to harm something very sacred and precious.
Appropriate fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about the dark night of the soul, if that's a term you relate to, and if that applies at all. Certainly when I think of the dark night of the soul, I think of it as a spiritual crisis. Is that something you relate to, and does that fit into this paradigm?
Yeah, perhaps. I'm not a big fan of unnecessary suffering, but I think that we have plenty of that. We don't need to manufacture more of it.
That's true.
Come on now.
That's true.
But
we certainly know people that...
Molting is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The caterpillar isn't... I don't know that it's dreaming of butterflies when its face melts into a mush that is not yet a butterfly. And so spiritual development, or just development, is often uncomfortable and can feel psychologically like you're dying. Mm-hmm. Ritual and rites of passage is kind of a controlled burn, or an attempt to facilitate that less destructively than just having the spirits flip your life upside down and shake it out. And so when we don't have rites of passage, they become organic, and they're just life events that shatter us and that we may or may not survive well. And so The Dark Night of the Soul. Yeah, sure, there's a stripping down that's super uncomfortable until we get used to it, mm-hmm. or even when we're used to it, I guess, that happens with a lot of stages of development.
So within the, you're an initiate in the Ifa Orisha?
It's true, yeah.
Tradition.
Yeah.
You have Western Africa, the Yoruba-speaking West Africans. How do they relate to this concept of spiritual transformation? Is there that sort of point of reference there?
I mean, if I can attempt to generalize, everyone has their own unique destiny, their own unique ori, we call it, or ipin for destiny. And so your job is to do a really excellent version of you and not someone else. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's formula for being a really excellent human being is slightly different. Having said that, we do come to the earth to develop good character and to be of service. And so if there's a goal, I suppose, it would be who can be the most helpful. If you want status, it means you have to help a lot of people. And if you want more status, then you have to be even more helpful. And so the way you build up your ashe is you walk in alignment with your destiny, you have good character, and you help people, you serve them. And know that that's going to cause you to show up on the radar of destructive forces and jealousy and negativity, because that's how the world is organized. And so you need to relate well with the destructive forces that would have you for breakfast also, and respect them also.
Healthy fear.
Yeah, and healthy boundaries and mm-hmm. warriorship to be fiercely protective of your own destiny, because there are beings who will interfere with it.
Mm-hmm. How do you protect your own destiny?
There's all kinds of things to say about that, but I'll say that...
Well, we still have about 17 minutes
yeah,
left.
Yeah, one of the best kinds of protection is to have people around you who will call you out on the places where you are not in alignment or in integrity. And so the swifter the feedback comes, the more protected you're likely to be. If you really follow that tightrope of integrity and balance in your life, there's a lot of inherent protection that comes from that. Mm. Beyond that, there are actual ritual actions to call in protection, but also being close with the spirits, having them around you, and listening intuitively when something's off in the dream time, and or you know, when your sense is off about a thing, come to the powers for divination. Ask what's happening.
So this sounds like prayer and meditation.
It is, and it's relationship with other deities. We have a number of shrines in our home, and so Eshu is, sure, there might be a part of me that is like that deity, but Eshu is its own kind of force and archetype deity, god, if you will, Orisha, and, you know, I could name others, but it's not just inner work, it's relational work, even though the ones that an initiate relates with are not only human. We call them Orisha, or forces of nature, also our ancestors or different aspects of divinity. So the sacred has many different faces. It's not just male, not just female. It's not only gendered, and it's not only friendly. It's not only accessible to you. And so there are many different temperaments and ways that the sacred can show up.
So, are there any risks involved in engaging our ancestors directly?
Sure, of course. You could tap into a bunch of heavy, ghosty energy and die prematurely. But there are risks in not engaging as well. Mm-hmm. It's like saying, are there any risks in engaging living people? Well, there are, and there are risks in avoiding them as well. And the ancestors are like that. Some of them are well, some of them are not. So if you're relating with the dead who are quite well on purpose, then it tends to be safer. And there are ways to safely assist those who are not yet well to become well.
How would that, give us an example of that, if you would?
Well, the method that I teach encourages directly coming into relationship with older lineage ancestors. Like if you wanted to dialogue with your father, let's say, you would ask first to contact an older grandfather along that lineage who's deeply well. And you want to make sure that the lineage that came after him, between him and your grandfather, including your grandfather, are deeply well, and that your grandfather has comfortably received your father into the lineage, and that your father is well seated with these older guides as well as his father. And at that point, they're safe to chat with. Before that, you can chat with them, but they're not technically ancestors yet. They're in the post-death, not yet ancestor, in-between status, which is a different kind of condition. It's those who haven't finished dying fully. And there are many among the dead that are in that condition because we have a cultural blind spot around it. So.
You know, when I was living in Mexico, I remember there was a death in the family right across the street from where I lived. And they had an open casket in their living room for days. And people came and went. They didn't go to some stodgy funeral home and have a wake. They put it in their living room, and friends and family came by, and you could look right through the window. It was right there. I would walk by, and there was Uncle Bob or whatever. Actually, it was a woman, as I recall. And so this went on for days and days and days, and they ate.
It's great.
They ate in the room. They laughed. They cried.
Yeah.
And it was about a week.
And when we do death like that, that's not just for the living. Mm-hmm. That also is a boost to the one who's passed in their journey to the next reality.
And in Mexico, I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say also in Mexico, they have Dia de los Muertos, which is Day of the Dead, and they would go to the cemetery. Now, some of the stuff they did was, get drunk. Seemed to be an excuse to get drunk. But there was, I certainly didn't have any kind of understanding of the ceremonies that they had.
Oh, sure.
Are you familiar with those?
To some degree, but there are rituals to feed our relationship with the dead and to feed them all around the world. And they can function in different ways. It can be feeding those who are not yet well to strengthen them to make the journey to join the ancestors. Or it can be just a feeding of the relationship that's already well as a celebration and an acknowledgement. And one of the things I want to circle back to with addiction is how the dead who are not yet well eat through us. When people drink, and they really drink with gusto, often they're drinking not just for themselves, but the dead are drinking through them as well. Or the ghosts are enjoying tobacco through the living, or they're binging on sexual energy or whatever the addiction is, sugar, let's say.
How would someone know that?
If you have the feeling that you're being taken over, in a sense, by a bigger energy or a bigger force, or something's very strongly compelling, then it could be the case that you are experiencing the additional craving of beings that are not only you. And yeah, so that's one way. And if you don't know that your own ancestors are well yet in spirit, and you haven't checked on that, then you might consider their own condition. We tend to construct ourselves very personal. And even something like, I'm not so knowledgeable about it, but let's say the 12 steps. We could easily have a cultural 12 steps where we make amends for our lineages. And if I say, so maybe I don't have a big component of addiction in my life, but if I'm working cultural 12 steps, I might need to make all kinds of amends for my lineages. Because I can't say in good faith that we inherit the blessings of our people, but not the burdens and not the unpaid debts. As a cisgendered, privileged white man, I have a whole ledger of unpaid ancestral debts.
There's a check to pick up.
There is.
Yeah.
And it's good for us. It's good for us to pick it up.
Yeah.
It brings greater intimacy into our lives and, by extension, greater resilience to ward off addiction.
And thinking about people in addiction, in most cases, there were people in their family, parents and other people in the past who were addicts.
Also eaten by ghosts.
Yeah, they may identify themselves as alcoholics or whatever, but it's a disease of addiction. And so we look at that. Some people say, well, it's genetic.
But it's lineage based.
I mean, the genetic link is a little, it's
sure,
it's questionable strong that is.
And many things are epigenetic, which is to say a physical reflection of the conditions of our people.
Yeah. But then we look at adverse childhood experiences that Margaret talked about before. Obviously, if an individual grows up with two parents who were alcoholics, there's obviously going to have been, there's going to be trauma in that family. So they would tend to want to gravitate towards some type of self-medication to get through the pain.
Indeed.
And you're saying there's a bigger scope than that.
To try it on for a moment from a generalized animist point of view, see addiction as a convergence of different kinds of interfering spirits or energies. With no judgment toward them. They're just eating, like parasites just eat. They're not evil or wrong because of it. But if you see, you know, pathogens, mosquitoes, whatever, a swarm of bats around a person who is nursing different addictions. If a child is raised in that environment, are they going to be in that field of energy? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And those energies can travel along bloodlines as well, which can include skipping a generation. If a parent has not deeply transformed the inheritance before them and they're just white-knuckling their sobriety, the addictive tendencies can, even if there's not a lot of contact with the grandparents, can transmit to the grandchildren. A lot of patterns, even genetically, travel every other generation. And so legacies can bypass a well-meaning individual who doesn't see the bigger systemic risk.
So let's say someone is listening to the show and they're in recovery and they're reflecting and thinking, you know, this is something I really want to look at. Mm-hmm. I think I want to talk to Dr. Four.
Yeah.
So they go to your website. Yep. Let's get that website out again.
It's ancestralmedicine.org.
And they contact you and say, I'd like to work with you, doctor.
Mm-hmm.
What? Give us an idea maybe what might happen.
Sure. In a first session, I'm not doing individual sessions with folks at this point. I'm referring them to people I've trained in the work. But in the method, if people were to seek out a practitioner or participate in the online course, the process begins with assessing, without judging, without intervening, what kind of condition are your four primary blood lineages in already? Your father's father's father's, et cetera, people, your father's mother's people. Think of your four grandparents and the lineage of women before the grandmothers and men before the grandfathers. So those four lineages, what kind of condition are they in spirit, in the present, and how much is that impacting you?
What if you're adopted?
Same. You just tune in with them.
Okay.
There's an assumption that we know this stuff. We can access this information. And that's been my experience over, you know, the last decade plus of stepping a few thousand people through this work, is almost everyone can just drop in and know this about their own family system. And because the ancestors, in a sense, they live within us. And we have access to that, like we have access to our own body knowledge. So assess what kind of condition your people are in, and then decide based on that where to initiate a cycle of healing and repair with one of those lineages. Contact the much older healed energy, and then partner with those healed ones to transform and heal up what's between you and them. So the whole lineage, including a deceased parent or grandparent all the way back to ancient times, is brought into a state of wholeness or health. And at that point, we're down lineage from a source of great blessing and context for our life and resilience.
There's a term in the field of addiction recovery called recovery-oriented systems of care. And they've gone to the acronym ROSC, which is actually not a acronym because it doesn't actually, it's not a word, but this is really recovery-oriented systems of care in a very broad, expansive sense, isn't it?
For sure, and it's not, the ancestors have such a deep, intimate, often kind of sneaky influence on us, and also the land here Like if someone's living in Western North Carolina and they haven't greeted the ancient river that moves through Asheville, or they haven't greeted the mountains here, or the trees, or the bear, or the smaller creatures, then there's a invitation to greater intimacy that's being missed. And to come into that relational field also means touching the painful history of occupation of traditional Cherokee land and the history of slavery in the South, and seeing that we're still in a process of healing from these difficult histories, too.
Are you familiar with Joan Halifax?
I am, yeah. I've sat with her a bit. Yeah.
Anthropologist and Zen teacher. She says, quote, "We think that the ancestors are behind us, but they also go before us. A vanguard, a spirit wave pulling us along." And then she says, "Until we give birth to our ancestors, Earth cannot be redeemed from its suffering. To exclude consciously or unconsciously any species from the continuum of existence is to deny a part of ourselves." Your thoughts?
No, I agree.
Yeah.
It's good.
And the other thing I thought about is the work of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen teacher. He has a practice called touching the earth practice, where I see my mother, my father, I see my grandparents. Are you familiar with his work at all?
A bit.
Does this kind of fit in?
I think so, yeah. To speak to Buddhism for a moment, many lineages of the Dharma that were brought to the West were somewhat decontextualized from traditional Asian valuing of tending to ancestors, tending to the land. And that's true not just of the Zen in Vietnam, but also Tibetan Buddhism.
Very much in Tibet.
Yeah, other lineages. And so people all around the world have traditions for tending to the relationship between the living and the dead. And everyone listening at some point had those practices as part of their own ancestry. They're possible to reawaken. They're possible to re-enliven and energize.
If you're hearing a sound in the background, it's our emergency broadcast system, which we're plugged into, and we can't turn it off, and it's just there. Do people do a lot of genealogical studies?
Oh, for sure. Genealogy it's helpful to know our history. And even if the research leads to painful times, whether it's slavery or history of occupation here, but genealogy information is helpful. It's like kindling that you want to bring to ritual. The important thing is our ancestors want to relate with us, and that we, meaning anybody listening, can just speak directly to the wise and loving grandmas and grandpas before you. Even if your family's a hot mess, even if your recent people are not people you feel good about, you go back far enough, there are earth-loving, ancestor-loving, kind, wise, healed ancestors in your lineages. And we can speak to them directly in the moment. And so I would want listeners to feel hopeful and encouraged, despite the kind of esoteric or out there way that some of these ideas can land, that it's actually quite normal and quite common. And the things about, let's say, Native American culture or traditional African cultures that folks tend to be taken by or they're really drawn by, those same teachings and sensibilities can be cultivated in our own everyday life here, no matter what your background is.
Well, that's very powerful. And it's a perspective that I think is so valuable at this time. We certainly need all the resources we can possibly come up with at this point in time. Thank you so much, Dr. Daniel Foer, for being a guest on A Mindful Emergence.
Thank you, Eddie.
Issued a flood warning for northwestern Rutherford, Transylvania, Henderson, southern Madison, Buncombe, and Haywood counties in western North Carolina until 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time Tuesday. at 6:56 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Doppler radar indicated heavy rainfall has ended across the area. Storm total rainfall accumulations of 4 to 7 inches caused widespread rapid rises on area streams with numerous streams exceeding their banks and causing minor flooding. Some locations that continue to experience flooding include Asheville, Hendersonville, Brevard, Waynesville, Marshall, Barton, Biltmore Village, Rosman, Davidson, Penrose, Chimney Rock, and Black Mountain. According to stream watches across the Warren area, several streams are above minor flood stage, which means they're inundating.